Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald and Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area and across the country for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today, we're talking with Tim Maloney and Nicholas Bernard, two of JGL's lawyers who practice in the area of civil rights. Our topic, civil rights cases, why, when, and how to sue police for improper conduct. Tim Maloney is a principal with JGL and has been heavily involved in significant litigation and administrative matters for the past 28 years. These matters include complex litigation in federal and state courts, in the District of Columbia and Maryland, and an extensive administrative practice before federal, state, and local agencies. Tim is a member of the District and Maryland Bar and is also admitted to practice before the Fourth Circuit of Appeals and the United States Supreme Court. In private practice, Tim has served as special counsel to the Prince George's County Board of Education and the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission, and Tim is a former Maryland Trial Lawyer of the Year. Nick Bernard is an associate attorney at JGL. His practice focuses primarily on representing plaintiffs in civil rights and other civil actions. Nick is licensed to practice law in Maryland, the District of Columbia, and Utah. Welcome, fellas. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us on.
All right. Let's talk about this recent civil rights case that you guys just filed here in Maryland. Tim, let me start with you. Tell these folks what the case is about, what happened, and why the lawsuit was filed.
Case involves two young men, Daniel Geralds and his friend Lamar Redfield, and they were driving one of their friend's cars in Anne Arundel County near Gambrills. They were going to see Daniel Geralds' mother. And while they were driving the car, they were pulled over for no reason by two Anne Arundel County police detectives. They later claimed they pulled them over because there was a lift sticker on the car and the car was only a two-door. Once they pulled them over, they pulled both individuals out of the car without any basis to do so. And then in the case of Mr. Geralds, they took Mr. Geralds, they said to them, get out of the car or I'm going to tase you. After threatening them, they placed them both in handcuffs. They were searched. They were not told why they were pulled over. They were pulled over of the car at gunpoint. Then when Mr. Geralds was put back in the car, at one point, Detective Rank involved. And then all the detectives pulled Mr. Geralds out of the vehicle, threw him on the ground, and then one detective took his knee and jammed it into the neck of Mr. Geralds and kept his knee on the neck of Mr. Geralds. This was a horrible situation. It's one that could have resulted in serious injury or death to Mr. Geralds. Fortunately for these young men, there were bystanders who videotaped the entire incident. So we have very clear film as to what happened. They were charged later with resisting arrest and other crimes which they did not commit. The Anne Arundel County State's Attorney's Office took a look at this, saw clearly that there was no crime committed, that the officers had no probable cause to engage in this conduct, and dismissed all the charges. One of the things that's really troubling about watching the video, and I've watched it over and over, is that you hear Mr. Geralds on the ground with the officer's knee pushing into his neck. Mr. Geralds is saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And of course, that sounds very similar to the tragic event involving George Floyd. So this was a terrible situation, and we've now filed suit against these officers in the Anne Arundel County Circuit Court.
So let me ask you folks, and Nick, feel free to weigh in. When these fellows or when Mr. Geralds comes to see you guys, what is it that you look for in order to determine whether or not, not just in this case, but also in any potential civil rights action, whether or not there is an action for inappropriate police conduct?
So the things that you want to look for, first of all, is you go to the very start of the encounter with the police. You know, was there a probable cause? Was there a reason that the police officer started following this person, that they pulled this person over, that they stopped this person on the street? legally speaking, police officers are given a lot of deference in terms of cause to pull people over, but they're not allowed to just do it for no reason. And so in this case, what we saw was these officers had begun following Mr. Gerrals and his friend about 2 miles before they pulled him over. The best justification that they could come up with for pulling him over was a Lyft sticker in the window of the car. You know, there was clearly no basis. So that's the start, is you see that there's no reasonable basis for even beginning a police action or a police investigation or a stop. Then what you look for after that is, how did the police officers conduct themselves during the stop? You know, were they calm? Were they reasonable? How were they treating the person? Were they yelling? Were they using their weapons or threatening to use their weapons? So in this case, the officers, after pulling Mr. Gerrals over in a residential neighborhood, got out of the car with their guns drawn and approached the windows of the vehicle, pointing their guns at Mr. Gerrals and Mr. Redfield. Obviously, no probable cause. There is no reason to think that either of these men were dangerous. Even by the officer's own account, which is contradicted by the video evidence in other places, all they did was fail to stop at a stop sign at some point and then proceed a quarter mile down the road before pulling over. You know, there's nothing about that that would indicate this is a person who's a threat to the life or safety of the public. So there's no reason to be pulling a firearm. There's no reason to be threatening to tase somebody. So that's number two. Then you move to, was the person actually charged with something legitimate? Was there a reason for the arrest? Here, Mr. Gerrals and his friend were pulled out of the car. They were handcuffed. They were searched. They were never told why they were being arrested. They were never told what they had done to supposedly aroused the suspicion of these officers. So that also contributes to the likelihood that there's an action here. And then, of course, you have the treatment of the person while they're in custody. That's sort of the last piece. You know, were they treated respectfully? Were they treated with force or excessive force? If force was used, what was the precipitating event, or what are the officers claiming? In this case, the officers claimed that Mr. Gerrals kicked at the windows, and in response to that, they hauled him out of the car, threw him on the ground in handcuffs. You know, like Tim said, one of the officers jammed his knee into Mr. Gerrals' neck. You can see on the video him picking up his knee and slamming it down on Mr. Gerrals' neck, slamming Mr. Gerrals' head into the ground, yelling at him. When Mr. Gerrals says, "I can't even breathe," the officer just looks down at him and says, "You can breathe." There's no effort whatsoever to respect the civil rights or even the basic humanity of Mr. Gerrals.
Let me ask you a question. What's your thinking here in terms of the police officer's motivation? Is this an incident that you believe is racially motivated in some way?
Yes. These are young African-American males in dreadlocks driving a late model car, and these were narcotics detectives. So you put the two together, and I think the combination was obvious.
Okay. Nick, I interrupted you there a moment ago, so feel free to finish your answer.
So the last thing I think is you look at the police officer's justifications after the fact. Here, the best thing they could come up with was the Lyft sticker story. They said things about Mr. Gerrals dragging his face across the ground, claiming that's why it was all scraped up. You know, when you can clearly see on the video that his head is being slammed into the ground by the officers, you know, and those sorts of falsehoods also indicate that the police are trying to cover up their own wrongdoing.
What does a lawsuit like this look like? What is it that you guys say in your suit, and what is it that you're asking for? People read about these kinds of things in the newspaper all the time and maybe not quite understand exactly what you're trying to do for your client.
Well, first of all, the client is asking for money damages, asking to be compensated for what happened to them, for having the indignity and the pain of having been pulled over, thrown out of the car onto the ground, having a knee into the back of his neck. But importantly, we're also asking for injunctive relief, which means we're asking the court to order Anne Arundel County to change their policies, to change their training, to change their rules and regulations so that this never happens to anyone again.
Where is this lawsuit filed? Is it filed in a state court, or is it filed in a United States in a federal type court?
It's now pending in the state court, the Circuit Court for Anne Arundel County. But we have the right, as the suit goes on, to add federal claims, federal civil rights claims, And if that happens, then it's very likely to end up in the federal court in Baltimore.
Let's talk about that for just a second. When you talk about federal claims, how do they differ from a state claim? And why would you, as a lawyer on behalf of your client, prefer to pursue or not prefer to pursue a claim in federal court versus state court?
State claims have a lot of advantages because you get to try them in front of state court juries right in the jurisdiction where it happens. But they have disadvantages, too. One of the disadvantages is right now they are usually capped at $400,000, the amount of potential recovery by law. Federal claims are different. Federal claims are typically removed and heard in one of two federal courthouses in Maryland, Baltimore and Greenbelt. They have the advantage of being uncapped. There is no cap to the amount you can recover. And you also can be entitled to attorney's fees if you prevail in the litigation. But they have some disadvantages too. The Supreme Court has a doctrine called qualified immunity, which has been misused by police officers over the years. And that enables them to say, we were acting in accordance with what we thought was lawful policy. And if they don't win in the federal court, they get to file an appeal even before the trial starts to the Fourth Circuit in Richmond to delay the case for a year or two. So there are disadvantages to going to federal court, too.
Nick, in terms of the litigation that rests on the client's shoulders, you know, what kind of things should a potential client of yours be looking forward to or not looking forward to, as the case may be, in this type of litigation?
So it obviously can be a long and sometimes difficult process. I think there's a lot of popular representations of litigation as this sort of quick to trial process. And at least with civil litigation, that's not really the case. You can expect to be in litigation if you go all the way to trial for over a year. So that's one thing that a lot of people don't quite expect. In terms of the actual process, we wind up collaborating with clients in discovery mostly. So we get documents from them. We talk to them about questions that the other side is asking. Eventually, the client is generally deposed, which can be an unpleasant process, but it's a necessary one. That's when essentially the client sits in a room with his or her attorney and with the other side's attorney, and the other side's attorney asks them a bunch of questions and makes them try to look like a liar. Or makes them, challenges them on their history, things like that. So that's part of the process that we as lawyers do a lot to prepare our clients for, because it's very important and it can be very stressful and very intimidating if you're not ready for it.
Is there any worry sometimes on your client's behalf, whether it's Mr. Gerald's or other cases that you guys have worked on, that there's some sort of retaliation that might happen? And, they're driving the same streets that they were driving when this happened. Other officers know that they filed this lawsuit. Is that a concern for folks that you represent sometimes?
It happens sometimes. We've seen people pulled over repeatedly by law enforcement officers. Years ago, I represented a young man, Curtis Martin Brick Jr., and none of the small town officers in Prince George's County liked him. And he was pulled over by the town of Cottage City. And one officer there unfortunately shot him, but he survived. He then filed suit and was successful. And then a few years later, he had an epileptic seizure across in the next town in Colmar Manor in the vestibule of the Burke Motley's restaurant. And another small town officer who knew of him and his history shot him and killed him. And we tried that case in federal court. And in the middle of the trial, the case settled. So, yes, there is a possibility, always a possibility of retribution, especially in the smaller towns. I will tell you a funny story, though. Years ago, there was a young man who sued the town of Fairmont Heights in Prince George's County because they had harassed him and used excessive force with him. And he won a judgment of $65,000. So he went out and bought a big Cadillac convertible, and he had printed in huge letters on it, "This Cadillac paid for by the Fairmont Heights Police Department." And he drove it all over town. So sometimes there's a funny twist to the story.
Follow that up. Is there any times when the officers who commit these offenses or who do these things to private citizens get charged with crimes as a result?
It happens not as often as it should. but sometimes it does happen. And we're seeing it start to happen more and more as the law enforcement accountability changes. But too often it doesn't. We represented Mr. Espina's family, and he had been shot and killed in Langley Park while he was getting ready to celebrate his birthday. His only crime was that he was drinking a beer outside his apartment house. In that case, the jury awarded $11.2 million. The officer, incredibly, was never charged and, in fact, promoted afterwards. But we do see sometimes the state's attorney increasingly taking action. We represent a woman now who was raped by a Prince George's County police officer while on duty behind the old Lido Shopping Center on University Boulevard. He's now been criminally charged. And when that case is over, a civil suit will be filed.
Do you, as private counsel for these folks, do you guys have any role in the event that there are criminal charges brought against the officers?
Our role is a limited one. First of all, to make sure that the victim is properly represented at the criminal trial and to cooperate with the law enforcement in bringing matters forward. And if we have evidence of our own, we share it with the prosecutors. And then we attend the trial to see what we can find out about the evidence. We sometimes learn more in the criminal investigation as well. And then we assist the victim in speaking about the victim impact.
Nick, how do you guys decide whether to take a case or not? I assume that you don't represent every potential client that comes through the door. So what do you look for when you're trying to decide whether to take a case like this?
You know, well, the first thing we look for is just whether it's a case that can be brought. Sometimes people, especially when they're traumatized by something that happens, they won't bring it up right away. And so it'll take them a couple of years to you know, go and look for counsel and say, hey, this thing happened to me and I want some justice. And unfortunately, because of the statute of limitations, which in Maryland for most of these claims is 3 years, sometimes there's just nothing we can do. So that's number one, is just a basic process to make sure that we can still recover. Number two, we just look for, you know, if they have any corroboration of the claims, what the nature of the claims is, if there's anything that, you know, seems off. It's sort of a case by case basis, and some of it's gut feeling. But we try to help as many people as we can.
All right. And last question for you, fellas. And we're here in Maryland in the District of Columbia, but are the laws the same? So if someone listening in is in Montana or California or New Mexico, wherever, is the law in those states going to be the same as it is as to these types of actions in Maryland, or may they differ?
The Fourth Amendment right to not be subject to an illegal search and seizure, that applies in all 50 states in the District of Columbia. But individual states have their own particular cultures, too, and their own particular statutes that may govern police behavior. But the federal constitutional principles remain the same.
All right. Well, thank you both very, very much, Tim and Nick, for joining us today on JGL Law for You. If there are clients, potential folks out there who want to talk to either of you, what's the best way for them to reach you, Tim?
Tell them to call us at any time, 301-220-2200.
And Nick?
I'd say the same thing.
All right, 301-220-2200. And each of you has an email, and you are on the www.jgllaw.com website. Is that right?
That's correct.
Excellent. All right, thanks to everybody for listening in. Please join us next time. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.